My castaway this week is an actor. He made his name in the 60s as PC Fancy Smith in BBC television Z Cars. Since then, he's appeared in dozens of roles, from Old Deuteronomy in the musical Cats to Augustus Caesar in I, Claudius. When he's not acting, he climbs mountains, real ones, like Mount Everest. 6 years ago, he made a film recreating the journey made by his hero George Mallory, who lost his life on its slopes. He's been back again since, and he plans another ascent later this year. Once you stop taking risks, he says, you start to lose. He is Brian Blessed. Is there any kind of link, Brian, between those two parallel activities of yours, acting and climbing? I mean, do you experience the same kind of fear on the stage on a first night as you might feel on a mountain?
Well, yes, I do. I feel very vulnerable about both. But I always feel that acting is holding up the mirror up to life, whereas climbing Everest or any of the great mountains, going on expeditions, that is life. And I find there's a very big difference between the sweat and fear of a first night at Stratford-on-Avon and being on the Lhotse face close by Everest.
But the panic is the same, presumably.
It is, but you're not going to lose your life at Stratford.
So how close have you come to losing your life?
Oh, well, I've got exceedingly frightened. I think last time I was rather shocked at a certain kind of vanity. I thought the mountain loved me. I thought I was a servant to what I was doing. And it was the worst monsoon conditions in 70 years, in 1993 in the autumn. You can imagine what it was like on Everest. And I descended the Lhotse face very quickly one evening, and the following day, the whole face avalanche, the worst ever, biggest recorded avalanche in Himalayan history. Then it started up other avalanches down the West Ridge and off there, and one came at me at 200 miles an hour, so I see it now 200 feet high, coming straight at me. And the leader and I, we just dived into a kind of small valley. We rolled and rolled and rolled and rolled and rolled. So dive, 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 dive. And the avalanche missed me by inches. It caught my heels. And I got up and I was so shocked. I raged at the mountain. What, I've only come here to do this and do that. What are you doing this to me for?
But is that part of the reason you do it? I mean, I said that you said that if you stop taking risks, you begin to lose. It's the risk taking.
Well, yes, I think it was Mallory who said the greatest danger in life. They said, isn't Everest dangerous? I said, yes, but the greatest danger in life is not taking the adventure. And an adventure can't be adventure unless it is tinged or manifest with danger.
Right. More of that in a minute, but tell me first about your first record.
Well, yes, I've chosen the Vaughan Williams Symphonia Antarctica. The Antarctic is so wonderfully wild, and it has a kind of astonishing magic and power and purity and loneliness, which I embrace. And it brings back great memories of being very close to God.
Part of Vaughan Williams' Symphony No. 7, Sinfonia Antarctica, with Heather Harper and the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andre Previn. I can imagine if you played that to yourself halfway up a mountain, you'd be terrified.
Yes, it does conjure up all kinds of memories. Extraordinary.
Let's talk about acting. For years, it was a case of mention the name Brian Blessed, and everybody said, ah, yes, Z Cars, PC, yes. Fancy Smith. Mm-hmm. It was the making of you, really, wasn't it?
Well, it was. I mean, I was interviewed for and read for the Norwegian Gunner in episode 5, and I got Fancy Smith. I'm quite sure had I read for Fancy Smith, I'd have got the Norwegian Gunner. No one ever knew why they called him Fancy Smith. But also, you know, people say, oh, we mustn't mention Z Cars. And I thought it was such a great series. I've seen about 14 of them recently, and I don't think television has been better. The close-ups, the reality, the nakedness.
And, so you're in no way ashamed of your acting origins?
No, sir, and I loathe actors who knock what's done them good.
Everybody remembers you for that, as I say. I mean, your voice, of course, and also, so if I may say, your bulk. I mean,
yes,
big
indeed.
Chap.
Yes, I've been very bulky.
Do you feel, therefore, that you've always been cast in the kind of villainous roles? You're the sort of big baddie, rather than the hero or the leading man.
Well, it's funny, so you, because you play, say, about four or five baddies, and they seem to kind of stick. I should say that three quarters of my roles have been rather goodies, really, or bad heroes.
You've been Long John Silver, I suppose.
I thought Long John Silver was one of the loveliest things I've ever been
and
in.
A musketeer, of course, which
and
is
Portos,
lovable.
And Portos, yes.
Have you ever been out of work?
I'm very lucky. I don't know. It seems that there's not many kind of loud-voiced men or bulky big men who can play pirates and kings and dukes and things.
You were a leading man to Katharine Hepburn once, weren't you?
Yes.
What was that experience?
Well,
like?
It was marvellous because it was for a film called Trojan Women that was made in 1970. Michael Kakianis, who directed Zorba the Greek. And he got Hepburn was Hecuba, Vanessa Redgrave was Andromache, Genevieve Bujon was Cassandra, and Irene Pappas was Helen of Troy. And I was the leading man.
And you rather fell for Katharine Hepburn.
Well, I did. I was told by Kakianis to be very honest. He rehearsed me for 5 months before the film. And he said, you must be honest with all these actresses. So I was petrified. It was my first big film lead. And eventually I met her, and we did the first scene together, and I thought it was dreadful. And by that time, I was kind of full of honesty and not diplomacy that Kakianis had filled me with. And she said, well, was that lousy? I said, yes. Was I lousy? I said, yes, I thought you were lousy. Really? Why do you think I was lousy? Well, I'd explain why. For all the reasons I thought she was being lousy in the scene. She was no longer a queen. I didn't have to give her this information. And the only reason I could give her this information is if you pester me. And we did it again, and she did pester me, and she was brilliant, of course, and acted me off the screen left, right and centre, and was wonderful. And from that day on, we were kind of two honest people together. She'd tell me if I was being bad, and I'd tell her she was being bad.
But you've said since, I considered spending the rest of my life with her.
I did. I lost her friendship. When we went collecting fossils together all over Spain, where we filmed Trojan Women. We went for the long walks and this, that, and then. And then I came back to London, she appeared in London. And my private life was difficult because everyone wanted to kind of really creep around Hepburn as she came to London. Everyone wanted to kind of do all that. And I couldn't face that. I kept her away from it. And she kept phoning up, can I come over and see you now? I'm afraid I'm going off. And then she stopped phoning. And now when I send her messages, she doesn't reply.
But, I mean, may I ask, did you actually have an affair?
No. We didn't. We just, it was platonic. But we held hands. I was very, very close. Arms round her waist and long, long walks. But I was very much simpatico. Very, 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 very close. I found her amazingly sexy. I think that had Tracy been alive, I'd have broken all his fingers to get to her.
Tell me about record number two.
When I lived in South Yorkshire as a child, on the right was the North Eastern Railway and on the left was a disused rail, and I used to see trains like the Mallard and the Flying Scotsman. And, of course, this was kind of really augmented by the fact that Paul Temple and Dick Barton, all these wonderful BBC series, were on the radio. And the title music to Paul Temple's series was Coronation Scott, which we all adored.
Coronation Scott, the signature tune from Paul Temple. So, Brian Blessed, you're the son of a Yorkshire coal miner, born a few years before the outbreak of war. Was it then that the classic childhood of its kind, you know, clogs and tin baths.
No, my mum was... we didn't have the tin baths, none of that. No, our bath didn't have any enamel on it. I remember my father used to bathe in it. There was very little white enamel on it. But my mother was adamant that I never wore clogs. And my father used to repair my boots. He was very good at that. So there's kind of pride in the house that I never wore clogs. I don't know why.
And were there the fears that, you know, your father was dead, falls at the pit and rushing to the pit?
They were amazing. My father was a great hero to me. He's still alive. He's 88, nearly 89. He was a coal hero. He did the hardest work in the coal mines. And there were no pit baths, so he'd come through the fog. There was lots of smog and fog and pollution then. And the wonderful lights. I'd wait for him, and I could hear and see the spark on his boots coming through the fog and the gas lights. And he'd have his lamp on his head, and his face was black. He had no baths. And to see him coming down, he just looked like a Greek god, and to pick me up. Now then, what have you been doing? What have you been doing? And he picked me up. This is so powerful. And I talk about the Dandy and the Beano and about this and that, and that Treasure Island was on curtain up on television. And I'd help him to kind of get his dinner ready, and then he'd fall asleep, and then I'd bathe his back. And his back was like a mountain landscape. It was all purple from all the roof falls all the time. Small roof falls, because he worked naked, because it was so, you know, so hot. And the dirt was inside his skin. And he'd stand up when he was washed, and I washed him, and he was all white and marble. It's very easy for the most unfit body, if it's brown and suntan, to look very fit when it isn't. But to see a white body, chiselled, I'm now so proud of him, you know.
And where was the fiction in your life? Was there cinema?
We had two, the Empire and the Cinema House. You could see Jungle Book with Sabu. You could see Flash Gordon. It's extraordinary, going to the Madness to see Flash Gordon. And I always enacted being Voltan, the Flying Hawkman. And, of course, later on in life, I never envisaged, but I actually played the part in the film.
Yeah.
That was a very strange feeling.
And is it true that the local cinema manager used to make an announcement, say, well, blind blessed, please go home because his tea's ready.
You've done your study very well, yes. Terrible. I'd go to the second house and the third house and the fourth house, and it would, please, will Brian Blessed please go home for his tea? His mother says he must come home.
And did you act at school?
Well, when I was 11 years old, I was asked to play Rumpelstiltskin. I remember the voice to this day. A little voice like that, Rumpelstiltskin, Rumpelstiltskin, oh, could he so. And I did it. And the headmaster said, well, Blessed, you're a very good actor. And I said, well, what's acting, sir? I had a tremendous Yorkshire accent, very thick Yorkshire. What's that? What's acting, sir? I said, well, you better find out, Blessed. So I commenced to find out.
Record number three.
Well, it's Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson was played all the time, that great bass baritone. All his songs were played. Of course, Old Man River was a great favourite. But my favourite was the canoe song from Sounds of the River. Are you going to go?
Paul Robeson and Canoe Song from Sanders of the River. You actually met him, didn't you?
Oh, it's a miracle. There was a tremendous festival. There was going to be no more war in the world. We'd had the war. It was now 1948, and a World Peace Congress took place in Sheffield, and thousands of people came from all over the world, from Russia, the Americas. Nations joined together. This was never again. No Bosnians, no nothing. It wasn't going to happen. And the climax of the occasion was at the Town Hall, a great concert, and Picasso was there. And
the Town Hall where?
The Town Hall in Sheffield. Uh-huh. There's a great and there was about 2,500 people there. I was fortunate to be in the audience, and I was actually sat alongside Picasso. I didn't believe it was Picasso. I was about 11 years old. I had this great thick Yorkshire accent. You're not Picasso. You don't sound Spanish at all. You sound more like Carmen Miranda. And he was, and all the school kids were around me as well. And this is the only way I can talk. And I said, if you're Picasso, draw something. And he drew this dove of peace, which I thought was awful. He says, that proves it. He looked awful. That proves you're not Picasso. That's awful. I'll draw you. And I drew him a dove. And I said, that doesn't look like a dove. And he offered it to me, and I turned it down. But he said to me, it's the first time I have a critic. Well, awful, terrible, isn't it? Awful, the ignorance of children.
But Picasso and Robeson in one day.
Oh, well, Robeson, and we all waited, because Robeson had made all these films. This great black actor who had made films in Wales with the coal miners, who could plead a cause. We waited for him, and he entered finally. It's all still, and he enters with these two lions of gold, and he stood there with his great black beaming face and gigantic 18-stone body. And he put his hand up, and he sang that canoe song, you know. Ayoko, and he started off. And he made the most wonderful speech about peace. And we were just, everyone wept, and I rushed backstage. We were very clever as children. I rushed back to the dressing room and got through Bill's legs, and I sat on his knee, because I got all his records. We all had. I said, Mr. Ropes, you didn't sing Ah Still Suits Me. You didn't sing Ah Still Suits Me, because he sang many songs. And he said, well, in actual fact, young man, he said, that's a duet. Do you know the words? Because I sing it with my wife. I said, well, yes, I do. So we started off. Does you ever wash the dishes? Does you do the things I wishes? Does you do them? No, you won't. Will you do them? No, you won't. And he replied, no matter what you say, Ah Still Suits Me. And I sang with Paul Robeson. And I went home that night just shaking with excitement.
How old were you?
11. 11 years old.
More music.
Well, I've chosen for the next record Daphne and Chloe. I find it the most haunting of all music. I adore those wonderful tales about South America, the Mato Grosso, the Lost World, that marvellous continent of waterfalls, Angel Falls, blue morpho butterflies and ocelots and cod-cods and electric eels. And I just, to feel the dawn coming up, daybreak through those jungles. And I think that Ravel does it in Daphne and Chloe beautifully.
Daybreak from Ravel's Daphne and Chloe, played by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Pierre Boulez. So, Brian Blessed, you left school early, you had to, the family needed you out at work, bringing in some money. You worked in an undertaker's, you worked on a building site, but you acted with the local Amdram.
Yes, I did. I left school really when I was barely 15. I was rather frustrated about that. I loved school. I was going to be school captain. I was going to be 880 yards champion and this, that and the other. And I had to leave because my father was injured by a roof fall and I had undertaker's assistant. But I did my schooling at night and the teachers helped me. And the amateur theatre now, I wanted to, with all my soul, be an actor.
And they gave you the lead, didn't they, in The Cure for Love?
Well, it was to think, you know, that I was kind of a coal miner's son and Maxborough was on a hill and I made the transition from being somehow a young teenager to being an adult, to be welcomed by people. I'd felt a bit of a failure. I had such terrible doubts. I almost had a nervous breakdown at 16 for various reasons. And miraculously, my speech teacher got me over that.
So you had a bad crit for that performance, didn't you?
It was my first lead, and I was caned by the critics, and they said I overacted and so forth. I didn't mind that, but it was in the press, and lots of rather negative people, and people in Yorkshire are very positive.
What, workmates on the building site?
Workmates on the building sites were very, very rude about it, and they printed at it, blown up the crit, and posted all over the building site, and I got into lots of scraps and fights. And so. And I was surprised. I thought I was kind of a strong person, but it can happened to anybody. Then gradually I suddenly found that suddenly my hearing wasn't so good, which surprised me. Suddenly from a distance people seemed as if they were down a tunnel, and then I realised I was beyond parental help.
You're kind of withdrawing from life.
Withdrawing totally, and I couldn't stop I couldn't stop the kind of negation and criticism that people had given me left, right and centre from the building sites. You know, they said I was no good and I was useless and I couldn't act. And I found myself saying, I can act. And 12 hours and 24 hours a day, couldn't sleep.
I suppose they thought you were affected, did they? That you were taking voice
lessons. They thought that I was above
and,
myself, that yes. I shouldn't learn to lose my Yorkshire accent. Well, the thing about speech is I've kept my Yorkshire expression and naturally lost the accent, though I can apply it again whenever I want. And my speech teacher, who I went to once a week for half a crown, 50 miles I'd trek on my bike to Rotherham for my speech lesson, I went in one evening and I just wept in front of him. I said, I'm a failure, I'm useless, and I fainted. And he washed my face, he sang songs to me, he quoted some of the great poets to me, some of the great philosophers in my ear for about half an hour, and I wept and wept and wept and wept, and I was cured.
But in the end, you left the building sites behind all of that, and you got to the Bristol.
Well, it was unthinkable. I mean, it was my biggest. I couldn't believe when I entered the doors of the Bristol Vic School, and inside was this mythological movement teacher, Rudy Shelley, who had helped me so much. The air was like wine, and there was the suspension bridge in the background, and Clifton Bristol, and I was going to school again. I think that's thrilled me more than anything.
Record number 5.
Well, record number 5 is Pat Doyle, who wrote the music for Frankenstein and Much Ado About Nothing, and has written the music for Henry V, Ken Branagh's first film. Branagh is a hero. We have this marvellous relationship. I love courage. You can never underestimate courage, physical courage. And that 7,000 British faced 60,000 French, and the French chose the ground at Agincourt. That is real courage facing the enemy, and this music, I think, really says it all.
Non nobis Domine, Domine, non nobis Domine, sed nomine, sed nomine, tuo da gloria.
Non Nobis Domine from Kenneth Branagh's Henry V, sung by Patrick Doyle and the Stephen Hill Singers. Let's get back to mountains then, Brian Blessed, to Everest. When did you first fall in love with it? Her?
Yes, is it, her. Very good. Yes. Well, I was 7 years old and I saw it in the Hotspur comic, this tale of Mallory and Irving, who disappeared on Everest in 1924. And that haunted me. They were dressed in Norfolk jackets and puttees and Homburgs, and they ascended a mountain 5.5 miles high. I mean, we 5.5 miles high, we thought, as young babies. My goodness, as far as Doncaster. Donny, 5.5 miles. And I was completely besotted by it.
But see, I wonder why it appealed to you so much. I mean, you whose father went deep underground and that was all you knew about. Why should mountains suddenly appeal to you?
Mountains I loathed and hated and feared. I found them terrifying. I also found them totally uninteresting as a child. And it wasn't until I was in Austria when I was about 25 years of age. I was in Innsbruck one day and I decided to just amble up the hillside up there and gradually got higher and higher. And suddenly the bell started pealing down below in Innsbruck. And then suddenly as I got higher and higher, even in the slowest movement, suddenly the mountains started to appear and the bells and the mountains. And it was kind of like a kind of veil being lifted. And I thought, where have you been all my life? There you are. That's who I am. Look at the mountains, mountains, mountains.
So it's a kind of spiritual experience.
Total.
Because you said before now that sometimes the need to conquer a mountain is connected with the need to prove your love for your wife, Hildegard Neale, for example.
Well, I did. I feel that marriage is so easy. You can get married, you can get divorced. But somehow, I feel you have to earn it. And I felt that I had to climb the hardest route on Kilimanjaro, and then I could propose to my wife. That sounds odd, doesn't it? But somehow I wanted to earn it.
So you made your first attempt on Everest in 1990. This was for the BBC, following in the steps of Mallory,
yes,
as you say.
Yes.
Apparently you saw ghosts up there.
Yes. The first time I went, I was at about 26,000 feet on the north face, and there in front of me, there was Captain Noel, and there was General Bruce, and there was Mallory and Irving and all of them. They're in front of me, and you're doing very well. And on this side, there are lots of adventures when you eventually come over here. Not yet, not for a long time yet, bless it. Lots of adventures over here that you'll never, beyond your imagination. But you'll have to go down very shortly. Now, I turned away and looked to the west and to the east and to the south, and the image didn't follow me. Then I turned back to the North Ridge again, and they were still sat there, and they were in the 20s gear.
And you had the Norfolk jacket on as well, didn't you?
I did, yes, I had the same gear on, yes. Of course, it means that I'm, as a person, I suppose, quite mad. People think I'm quite mad, and I embrace that. I think when people tell me I'm mad, then I know I'm on the right track.
Record number 6.
Well, when I was on Everest, I couldn't get it out of my head, that wonderful theme of Sibelius's 5th Symphony. I couldn't get it out of my head. And that's what I'd love now.
The end of Sibelius Symphony No. 5 in E-flat major, played by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by Sir Alexander Gibson. So, Brian, you went again to Everest in the autumn of 93. You got to 28,000 feet without oxygen. Now, 16 people in your party reached the summit that time. You refused cylinder oxygen,
exactly.
So you physically couldn't conquer Everest yourself. Why did you do that?
I just felt, Sue, that the southern side of Everest is the so-called easy side of Everest. Well, it's not easy at all. In fact, the objective dangers on that side are pretty dreadful, the icefall, etc. So those 16 who got to the summit did magnificently well. I mean, they're brilliant, and some of them nearly died. But I felt there was no adventure on the southern side. 53, up went Hillary and Tensing, and it's been climbed many, many times since then, and I suddenly dawned on me, it is much more of an adventure if a dotty, stupid 58-year-old tries it without oxygen. I was doing very well without oxygen. Let's see what I can do. And I hated the oxygen on my face and the masks. I was losing the mountain. I couldn't feel the mountain, this bloody mask on my face. Claustrophobic and so forth. So I wouldn't have it. I was going very fast. I was on the second assault team, and I was actually a quarter of a mile ahead of everybody. How wonderful! And I got to the South Col, and I came across a dead body, dead Indian who died. He died horribly. He couldn't get into his tent, frozen. He'd not been able to unzip it because he was so frozen. Had he unzipped it, he'd have been alive. I said a prayer, sat by his body. And I'd somehow felt him talking to me. Go on without. Try. Go as high as you can without. They set off at midnight, and I was tempted. Oof. The vanity of an actor. No, I threw it away and said no. And went on my own when it got towards light, went on my own. But of course you're going slow and you need backup. You need someone alongside you with oxygen in case you hemorrhage or in case your brain starts to blow and so forth.
So it wasn't a case of fear. It wasn't a case of seeing a dead body and suddenly thinking, I've really pushed myself as far as I can go.
No, I wasn't even tied at 28,000 feet. I turned down because if I'd have gone on ahead on my own, I'd have endangered other people and I'd have died. Had I got backup with me, I did this without anyone knowing, you see.
So why are you going back
again? The leader disapproved of what I did, but I did this without anyone knowing, you see.
But why are you going back again? Because you still need to conquer that mountain.
I feel the job is now unfinished. I will use oxygen, probably. I'll try and do it without and have backup. Have two very strong Sherpas alongside
me. But you're determined to get to the top.
Yeah, and not for me. I'm going to get a lot of money for the Gurkhas, get money for this and the Tiger and things like that. You can't just climb these mountains and do these things for yourself. That's potty.
Next record.
Well, in actual fact, it is the Gurkhas, men of the hills, and the Gurkhas are the Sherpas on Mount Everest. They come from the Solo Kumbu, they come from Tibet, there's a Mongolian extract, and they fought us in the war, we couldn't beat them, and they couldn't beat us, and East and West joined together, and they love us over there. And on the mountains, I mean, they'll die for you, and they give so much and ask so little. And the man who begat the Gurkhas was General Bruce, who was on the expeditions in the 1920s, a giant of a man. He led the 24 expedition. And I'd been given his ice axe. attacks by his family, which dates from 1879, this ice axe. And I'm going to use it next time on Everest, and I'm using it as a symbol to raise money for the Gurkhas.
Band of the Brigade of Gurkhas and Men of the Hills, and their motto, I understand, is it's better to die than to be a coward. So what about you on this island, Brian? You're not going to be happy unless it's got a mountain in the middle of it, are you?
It would be very nice to have a mountain. They usually do. I return to Treasure Island, Long John Silver. I was different parts of Jamaica, which was very interesting, and they had the Blue Mountains in the background, of course. But I was astonished at the kind of dangers of an island. The island can be quite hostile.
Because I was thinking you were an ideal candidate, really, because you liked nature.
Well,
and...
I do. Of course, the people will say, well, he's full of energy, Brian Blessed, and he has a very loud voice and this, that, and the other. But in actual fact, I'm a very quiet man. On expeditions, people have to bellow to get me to join them. I tend to be on my own a lot. I enjoy being on my own, or, of course, you're not alone. And I love to meditate twice a day for half an hour. I kind of relate that to the Shankaracharya of northern India that I've done since I was 27 years of age. And I find my greatest yearning is silence and stillness. So the solitude I think I could cope with. I think now I could cope with. Not so if I was a young man, but now I think so, that I can kind of face my fears. As a young man, the blood is pounding very, very hard and the problems are almost unreal and panicky.
Last record?
Well, the last record is Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, that wonderful throbbing, almost like volcanoes. But I love, of course, the whole piece. Again, it relates to my childhood, and I was so disappointed as a child that there were no dinosaurs. I'd love to be a time traveller and go back there and just sit and watch them, because I'm sure they're wonderful mothers. You know, they're always fierce, but they're wonderful darling mothers, the dinosaurs, and different coloured skin and so forth. And I miss all that, and I'd find kind of listening to Stravinsky's Rite of Spring transcendental.
Part of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. If you were only allowed to take one of those records on your desert island, Brian, which one?
The Rite of Spring, the last one. It is varied. That's rather volcanic and full of volcanoes. Then it goes very pastoral and very deep and very ritualistic and strange and poetic. It's wonderfully varied, and it seems to kind of touch the brain on many levels.
What about your book?
I'd want to, because I've never quite understood it, or not remotely understood it, is Ouspensky's In Search of the Miraculous. Ouspensky was a scientist, writer, a tremendous explorer as well. He went around the world to try and find the meaning of life and what it was all about. And he travelled through, he met all the rishis in India and went to different continents and ultimately ended back in Russia. An astonishing book and full of bravery and insight and poetry and passion.
And what about your luxury?
Well, my luxury is a scarf from the Dalai Lama. It's a beautiful pattern scarf that he gave me. I met him in 1990 and he advised me about Everest. And he's blessed me. I've seen him several times since then. And he's now ultimately given me this scarf. He wants me to place it on the top of Mount Everest. And so three mantras, a rather complex one for the peace of mankind, a mantra relating to the Dalai Lama himself, and one to the mountain itself.
So he believes you're going to get there?
He does. He says, I'll suffer this time, but I won't die, I won't get injured, but I'll go through hell, but I'll make it, he says.
Brian Blessed, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, sir.